We've been going deep on the Secret Service here on Solving JFK. And aside from the claims about Bill Greer and George Hickey, which we've ruled out, the big question is whether the Secret Service was grossly negligent or whether the actions that made the president less secure were intentional. There are very few people in the world of JFK assassination research who are clear experts in a particular field. But today, we have the exception to that rule. We are joined by Secret Service expert, author, and researcher Vince Palomara, coming up next on Solving JFK.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
I don't know what this is all about.
Dallas police this morning resumed custody of the man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
I'm just a patsy.
The man is Lee Oswald.
Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? Commission answers, he acted alone.
Vince, welcome to Solving JFK.
Oh, thanks a lot, Matt. Appreciate you having me on, and thank you to you and all your viewers and listeners.
And I was mentioning to you a little bit before we started recording that I've been aware of your work since I first saw you on The Men Who Killed Kennedy when I was in college. And, you know, the fact that you had the dedication to track down every single, not every single, but pretty much every living Secret Service agent that you could find, ones who had information about what the motorcade would have been like in the fall of 1963. That's amazing, especially that you started at such a young age. So kudos to you.
Thanks a lot. Yeah. You know, there was a little bit of a natural handicap because some of the men had passed away in the late 60s, early 70s, even into the early 80s. So from a period of time from 1990 on is when I contacted a lot of these gentlemen. But still, yeah, I was lucky to get them because some of them passed away within like 6 months to a couple years, you right. know, give or take. Yeah, so yeah.
And so you said, when did you start interviewing them?
I'd say like 1990. Right. It was Richard Greer, Bill Greer's son, and June Kellerman, the widow of Roy Kellerman. And then we really get into 1992 on, it's primary agents, Jerry Bain, you know, Winston Lawson, Floyd Boring, et cetera. Yeah.
That probably took a fair amount of effort, you know, in a pre-internet world, you know?
In a pre-internet world, what it was networking. It was a little bit of luck. It was the Washington, D.C., Maryland area, a little bit of Florida, directory assistance in networking, you know. Some of these agents were just tickled pink that I was doing this. They were like, oh, you know, Bob Lilly lives in Niceville, Florida. Hey, if you want to contact him there, and so on and so forth. So it was like a little bit of that too. So that helped a lot. Yeah, cool. No doubt. Yeah.
And what made you choose the Secret Service as your area of expertise?
Well, going back to 1978 when I was 12 years old, so between the summer between sixth and seventh grade, my mom and dad, big fans of President Kennedy, and they were touched by his death as well. And again, I'll make a story very short. I always do this, but yeah, I was into stamps and coins, foreign stamps and coins. And whenever I get all these foreign countries, I was amazed at how many pictures of John F. Kennedy were on them. So then my mom and dad regaled me with stories of his life and death. And at the same time, it seems incongruous, but there was, and it's still my favorite show to this day, The Wild Wild West. It's a fictional show about the 19th century Secret Service. So I just kind of naturally gravitated toward the Secret Service. I remember just like seeing newsreels, even Zapruder film, Nick's film, whatnot. And I would look past Kennedy and look at, oh, I see that agent. I've seen him before. He must be the agent in charge. And it just fascinated me. The book 4 Days had really nice still photo of Love Field and Sam Kinney behind the wheel of the follow-up car, Clint Hill, and so on and so forth. So I just became fascinated. Thanks to that fictional show, it just kind of made me gravitate toward the Secret Service. So, yeah.
Were you fascinated in the Secret Service in terms of like you thought they were cool, or like, and you were interested in them, or was it more like, hey, something went wrong that day? These were the guys that were supposed to protect them. Let's knock around and see if there's anything going on there.
Yeah, a combination of both. And I just want to say that at first I did believe a lot of what I call pablum. At first I did begrudgingly believe that President Kennedy ordered the agents off the car, didn't want the bubble top. It was within those restricted handicap parameters that I thought that they were still negligent. They still could save the man's life, so on. But at the same time, I'm a big fan of the Secret Service. I don't cast aspersions on the agency. I don't think the Secret Service was behind the assassination per se. I have a few suspects of agents that might have crossed the line. But sure. Like the agency as a whole, no. And I was always, to this day, thousands of men and women have served in the agency from 1865 to the present. So I have a lot of respect and admiration for them. But obviously, I feel that it's my tagline, Oswald or no Oswald, conspiracy or no conspiracy. If these men would have done their normal professional job pre-November 22nd, not looking through rose-colored glasses of modern-day post-9/11 protection, technicalities, whatnot, I think the president would have lived. Just what they did between FDR, Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy era, I think that the man would have lived. So, yeah, sure. Fascination and a little bit of criticism, too, yeah.
All right. Well, the way Solving JFK works is that we cover a topic over a few episodes, and then we break down the main points while visiting any rebuttals that came in along the way. So we got a lot to cover today. Let's go ahead and jump into it. The first thing, Vince, is the excessive drinking. So we won't spend too much time on this, but 9 of the Secret Service agents stayed out until 3 a.m. drinking. And, you know, witnesses said that this was Everclear, not just like a beer or two. And yeah, they had to be on duty at 8 a.m. the next morning protecting the president. Now, to me, it didn't seem necessarily nefarious, but it potentially could explain the sluggishness of some of the agents. The biggest question I had about this for you, Vince, is why do you think there was no one from LBJ's detail at the cellar? Do they hang out like in separate like social cliques? I found that to be an interesting fact.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, it's grist for the mill for people that believed LBJ had something to do with it. Yeah. At one time years ago, I was leaning that way. Now I just think he was part of the cover-up, not part of the conspiracy per se. But now, having said that, it's a historical fact. None of the, Rufus Youngblood, Stu Knight agents, and they weren't White House detail agents. They were Vice President Lyndon Johnson agents. So you're correct. Yeah, were involved in the drinking incident. And it was actually about 16 or more agents were actually out between the Fort Worth Press Club and the cellar. And then 9 admitted to drinking. Now, it could be a limited hangout. You got to keep in mind, this is what they're admitting. Now, there's a few press people in my first book, Survivors Go, I talk about how not just the famous one from 1984, Pat Kirkwood, saying that they were bombed. You know, these men were drinking, you know, pure Everclear grain alcohol, whatnot. But even a couple other newsmen said, oh, yeah, these men were definitely drinking, carousing late. In fact, Paul Landis admitted he didn't get out of there until 5:30 a.m., had a report for detail 8 a.m., also admitted in his book from a couple years ago he got no sleep. So sleep deprivation and alcohol consumption, and here's the bottom line. Volume 18 of the Warren Commission volumes, there's a little excerpt from the Secret Service manual. It says that drinking while on travel status is grounds for removal from the Secret Service. So you had 9 agents, 4 of which were on the follow-up car. You had Clint Hill, Jack Reedy, Glenn Bennett, and Paul Landis all admitted to drinking. Some said, yeah, I had a couple scotches and sodas. I had, you know, 5 beers, this, that, and the other. Whether that's true or not, it's still, you know, grounds for dismissal, grounds for punishment. Yet these men, you know, were supposed to report for duty 8 a.m., you know, the president's killed under their watch, and there's no repercussions. You know, there was begrudgingly because of, the name eludes me right now. The guy who did the gossip column came out and Drew Pearson. Yeah, that's it. Drew Pearson talked about how, oh, it should be investigated. It's unbelievable. They were drinking that morning and the night before, only because at the Secret Service launched an internal investigation. We could say it's kind of like the fox, you know, guarding the chicken house. How much did they really have a vested interest in getting to the bombers? But the bottom line, no one was punished. And in his finest hour, Chief Justice Earl Warren grilled Chief Riley under oath to the Warren Commission, said, don't you think these men would have been better off if they were well-rested, not hanging around beating at clubs, you know, paraphrasing, cellar and whatnot. And then Chief Riley was just unbelievable. He said, I don't think these men could have prevented the assassination. I didn't want to stigmatize these men or their families. Meantime, it's like we lost a president. You know, back in 2012, 9 agents drank and crossed Cartagena, Colombia. President Obama wasn't even on the site, and yet heads rolled. Some of the men were dismissed. They were demoted. They were punished. It was all news all over the place. In fact, ironically, the irony is rich. Clint Hill in 2012 on C-SPAN addresses the 9, you know, lunkheads who drank that before. It's like, oh, my God, Clint, you were one of the ones that lost the president. Nothing happened to Obama. So that there's that. Yeah, it was definitely – I mean, you could either take the tack that these men were there and they were plied liquor to kind of corrupt them. They wanted their own volition. Now, I know that Jerry Bruno, Democratic National committee advancements on record to the House Select Committee. Says, oh, these were not one or two beer drinkers. They really put it away. This is not the first time this happened. They were in Italy. One of the agents pulled a gun on the bartender to keep the bar open for a while. And Abraham Bolden famously has said, this is not the first time these men have done this. Sure. So, yeah, Dad. So, yeah.
All right. So we got our first rebuttal here. And this is Danny in Birmingham, Alabama. And he says, Matt, you said that Agent Jack Reddy. And real quick, here's what's fun about this. I called him Jack Reddy. And I'm happy to update it to the correct pronunciation of Jack Reedy. Because
only clearly, too recently, I found out, only like about 5-6 years ago, I found out that's the real way you pronounce it. Yep. Because it's like, well, Jack not ready. He wasn't ready that day, but it's Jack Reedy. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah,
indeed. He was not ready. But anyway, okay. So Matt, you said that Agent Jack Reedy failed to act because he was hungover, but Emery Roberts is the one who told him not to move in the follow-up. Oh, yeah. So that's
a combination. Sure.
That's true. And I didn't mention it, so I do want to get beyond the record mentioning that Emery Roberts did tell everyone in the follow-up car to move. Benz, can you fill in that on Emery Roberts, you know, what he told the folks in the follow-up car?
Yeah. First of all, just real quick, and we'll go into detail. Like, my three suspects of agents that crossed the line either into gross negligence or something sinister: Bill Greer, the driver of the follow-up car; Floyd Boring, number two agent in charge of Planet Texas Trip, and Emery Roberts, who was a shift leader, and he was the agent in charge of the agents in the follow-up car, the car right behind President Kennedy's car. And when the shooting, I just preface this by the remark that in Livingstone and Groden's book, High Treason, an early classic, well, not that early, but late 80s, Harry Livingstone, who I got to know real well and become friendly with his later books, made a comment in there that Emery Roberts ordered the agents not to move. And I was like, that's fascinating, but there's no sources. Where is he getting this? Did he just, like, hyperbole, you know, make exaggeration? So during my interview, one of three long ones of Sam Kinney, the driver of the fob car, was a foot away from Emery Roberts. I said, is this true? And I was expecting an avalanche of denial. No, no. He goes, no, exactly right. And I got hot in mouth. I was like, huh? He goes, yeah, exactly right. Yeah. And I'm sort of involved in that too. I just slowed down the car. And then he kind of hemmed and hawed, well, you know, we're worried about, you know, Jack Reedy, if he was going to get run over, and Clint Hill for that matter. But then again, Clint already left the car at that point. And I talked to other agents, later agents, and things like Dan Emmett, who's an author who protected President Bush 41 through Bush 44. And he said that you don't worry about your own safety. This is ridiculous. You're supposed to be there to cover and evacuate. They should have lunged forward. You don't restrict your men. You let them go on their training and instincts and common sense. You don't sit there and right. You know, do something like that. So, yeah, bottom line about Emery Roberts is he was a shift leader and he was in charge of the other agents. At Love Field, he recalled two agents, Henry Ripka and Don Lawton, famously. I discovered this in 1991, the black and white footage of him at Love Field. But when the shooting began, okay, you see the Alkins photo and they're kind of looking at Clint Hill. Looks like he's looking at, you know, JFK, and he's like this. He orders the men not to move. And you talk about restricting, you talk about something sinister, and this is grist for the mill for the LBJ Dinocrat. Emery Roberts went on to be appointment secretary for LBJ. He effectively replaced Dave Powers, who was riding in the follow-up car with him. And it was like press reports I have in my couple of my books, and they were saying, well, what is this agent, this active agent, talking to the prime minister of Japan for? What's he doing that for? And again, he was an appointment secretary at the same time he was an active agent. That has never happened before or since. The closest we ever got was a couple of retired agents became kind of aides to a president, but never an active agent. So it was very bizarre. Yeah.
Interesting. We're going to get to the Ripka Lawton thing here in a little bit. Okay. Second issue, bubble top removal. So the bubble top was specifically ordered for Dallas via an FBI airtel. And that really opened my eyes. That was news to me.
Yeah.
And question I have for you on that, Vince, this memo, this airtel says, quote, the bulletproof bubble type Lincoln automobile was being flown to Dallas. Yeah. And my question is, was that referencing just the bubble top, or was there a specific vehicle that went with the bubble top that was being flown in just for Dallas?
Was it? No, it was the 1961 Lincoln, the SX-100. It's the one they're talking about. Now, the thing is, while it might technically have not have been bulletproof and that was a mistake, it was such a common mistake that even the special in charge of the Dallas office, Forrest Sorrells, called it bulletproof. The public at large thought it was bulletproof. So again, if it's on there, even though it's not officially bulletproof, although agents I spoke to thought it was bullet resistant or at least would deflect a bullet, okay, you would think anything would help at all. would a prospective assassin fire seeing that on? Because if the presumed wisdom, which turned out not to be correct, is it was bulletproof, would they have even fired? And yet Winston Lawson saying the sun's glare off at the metal strips helped. You know, you think anything would at least deflect a bullet. And it was a psychological deterrent, if nothing else. And it turns out through research that somewhere between one-third to a half of all President Kennedy's motorcades, he used the bubble top, often in very nice weather. He's smiling ear to ear and all this stuff about get that goddamn bubble top off, this myth. And I tell people this over and over again, it's only the last 5 to 15 years that so many of these photos and films have become public domain, been released, remastered, released for the first time. So, because for the longest time, Matt, for years, we only had the inaugural motorcade in Dallas and very little in between. So it was hard to really be definitive about things. And now, thanks to the White House photographers passing away and their photos and films becoming public domain, and so many other people in the news and amateurs releasing them on Facebook, of all things, or Twitter, saying, oh, look, my grandfather took a photo of Kennedy in Nashville, Tennessee. And you're like, oh, my God, here's the bubble top. So it's just from years of collecting. But it's the last 5 to 15 years that, in fact, I even have a video on my YouTube channel. It's one of the last 15 or 20 videos or so. And it collects, it's over 2 hours long. It's all President Kennedy's motorcades. I just want to stress enough too, President Kennedy didn't have a motorcade every single day. He was only president, unfortunately, from 61 to November of 63. So it was a finite number of domestic and foreign motorcades. So you can really do a percentage and say, wow, look, there's no rain to be found. Look, there's the bubble top on. Sometimes there's even agents on the back of the car, whatnot. So again, now, specifically about Dallas, Sam Kinney, the driver of the FOB car, was adamant to me. I mean, he was so adamant. I mean, he was just like, this is it. I, meaning Sam, I'm solely responsible for the bubble top's removal. He said JFK had nothing to do with it. Kenny O'Donnell had nothing to do with it. You know, even like Forrest Sorrells, who's an agent, but he's been blamed by the late Jim Lehrer in his book. He's, I don't know what you're talking about. I made the decision. It's one of my, then, keep in mind, it's the early 1990s, when he's telling me, it's one of my 30-year regrets if this was something I should have done and whatnot. So you could just look at it as an avenue not explored, rather than being something sinister per se, that they could have had the bubble top on a partial form, just the front and rear piece, and leave the middle open for some air and for JFK to intermittently stand when the car is going at a decent speed, by the way. But you had that too. So was it just an option not explored? But what makes it a little bit sinister is the fact there's all this blame on Kennedy afterwards, one of several elements of this sort of thing. You know, he had a rendezvous with death. They say, well, we all were rendezvous with death. We're not immortal. We're all going to die sometime. But it's just like a romantic Shakespearean type of thing they throw in him. Then they say he was reckless in his private life. That's been a little exaggerated, but it's true. And then they throw on he's reckless of his security, because it adds this sort of Shakespearean tragedy to his life. Triumph and tragedy of the Kennedys. He didn't want that bubble top. He didn't want those agents in the back of the car. He didn't want the motorcycles around him. It's all bull. But they threw that on him. And what it did is got everybody's eyes off the Secret Service, Matt, because for years people were like, well, they're the good guys. Let's talk about the FBI, the CIA, the mafia. Those are the good guys trying to figure it all. Right. Clint Hill, bless them. And it was until you realize that Clint Hill got there. I don't want to get off on a tangent and answer your questions directly, but yeah, just in a general way. Yeah, Clint Hill got there when it was all over and done with, if you want to be brutally honest about it. And he drank the night before, and he was a Jacqueline Kennedy agent, not a JFK agent. So there you go.
So, and thank you. And I know you just know so much, so it's hard to not.
Like, sorry.
I get it. I do. just to make sure I understand about the limo and the bubble top and this memo. It was the same limo for all the Texas trips. It's just the bubble top itself was flown in, or was it a different limo?
No. Well, here's the thing. It was the same limo that he used, 1961 Lincoln you see in so many Carlos motorcades. However, let's see, Houston and Fort Worth, he used a different limo. So in San Antonio, he used the same limo. He used an open rented limo in Houston and Fort Worth while the limo was being flown on the C-130 to Dallas. Okay. So there's sometimes, if you look at the trip to Ireland, sometimes he used the motorcade. Well, was he using the Secret Service FOB car? Sometimes he did it out of necessity because, you know, he's in Dublin, but they're going to Limerick or whatnot in Ireland. Uh-huh. And, we got to transfer the others. So who sometimes used the Eisenhower bubble top for his cars. Yeah, sometimes he used the Eisenhower bubble top or the Secret Service follow-up car and have a gaggle of agents standing all around him for protection. I think that's what LBJ did in 1964 when they were working on remodeling the bubble top. They used the Secret Service follow-up car. So that's old myth about, presidents never again used an open car. LBJ used the car, open car, plenty of time in 64. But yeah, to answer your question, yeah, no, it was the car. It's a little convoluted because sometimes I had necessity to use a rented car. Now, to be fair, those stops in Houston, Fort Worth, he had a ton of motorcycles all around, and they were going at a much faster rate of speed. In fact, if you've seen Houston motorcade footage, there was two phalanxes, two links of motorcycles around the car, and they were going at a much faster speed. So there's that too. So
yeah. And people who want to see this motorcade footage, do go check out Vince's YouTube page. Lots of really good material there on that.
Thanks.
There are many ways to relax after a long or stressful day, and one of my favorite ways is legal cannabis. Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door, and they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients so that you can target nearly every mood or health concern that you can think of. I'm talking about Mood.com's incredible line of functional gummies. And you can get 20% off on your first order at Mood.com with promo code JFK. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood that you're looking for. So head on over to Mood.com to find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. Don't forget to use promo code JFK when you check out to save 20% off of your first order. Moving on to the next topic, local law enforcement stand down. Okay, so let's talk about this in terms of the sheriffs and then in terms of the police. So for the sheriffs, they did not participate at all. That's correct?
Correct.
What was typical for sheriffs?
Well, it was very typical. Go ahead.
I was going to say, is it just they looked at it in terms of local law enforcement comprehensively, or did they make a distinction between sheriffs and police in cities when they would visit?
Yeah, they would definitely do that. It's a manpower thing, and they would make sure, obviously, you got the local safety. You can't have, like, you know, banks being robbed, stores being robbed while there's a motorcade, but there's a manpower push and the emphasis on the protection of the president. So they would have the local police, the sheriff's department, in this case, also the Texas Rangers. You had all that in addition to the local field office or offices, depending on where you're at, and the White House, you know, detail. So you'd have all those in conjunction. So normally, yes, it was normal. In fact, you even just looked the major trip before in Florida, and the ones that weren't shredded by the Secret Service, so the documents that survived, talked about, matter of fact, the Sheriff's Department guarded multi-story buildings along the whole, what turned out to be 28-mile motorcade. It was the longest domestic motorcade President Kennedy ever undertook. Yet they could protect him tremendously in Tampa, yet he gets to Dallas. It's only 10 miles in length, and they did what they didn't. Did what they didn't do. But to answer your question directly, yes, we know infamously Roger Craig's on film in 1975, I think it is, or 74, the year before he died, talking. It was for Mark Lane, but another gentleman's interview. I mean, you know, Roger Craig famously is saying that, you know, Sheriff Decker told us to in no way participate in the security of this motorcade.
Right.
We were there as spectators, nothing more. Now, here's the thing is Larry Sneed interviewed Sheriff's Department people. And Larry Sneed, it's not that he kind of like leaned towards Oswald did it thing. So it's very interesting, his interviews, they basically say that the sheriffs that he interviewed said, yeah, we didn't participate in it. There was no different kind of police formation. Yet Sheriff Curry in late October made headlines in Dallas, it's gonna be the largest police force ever for the protection of a president. And yet we have stories of the police facing the limousine, not facing the crowd. They were limited in number. Jesse Curry talked about in his book how security was ended just a matter of fate right before they got to Dealey Plaza. So, and then also Sheriff Decker is on record. I have it in my first book talking about how he said to Forest Sorrels, I'm going to contribute 10 to 12 extra men. And yet they're standing in front of the Sheriff's Department on Main Street just as observers, nothing more. So I think what it is, a classic case of, I'm going to tell you something officially, but I'm going to do what the hell I want. I want to protect this Yankee. You know, they weren't fancy. I mean, a lot of these guys were, you know, John Birchers, Ku Klux Klan, or at the very least, they were conservative Republicans. They didn't care about this Yankee. Like, you know, I can't say it on the air, but, you know, Bill Alexander, assistant DA, famously said something pretty foul about President Kennedy, got his, you know, butt wiped out in Dallas. And, you know, even Jim Lovell said, as far as I'm concerned, this is another N-word killing in my book. Like, they really downplayed even the death of Kennedy. So there was this attitude in Dallas. And, you know, it's a city that President Kennedy was warned about. He had the wanted for treason signs and, you know, welcome President Kennedy or welcome Mr. Kennedy to Dallas. And, you know, yet he was warned, you know, Senator Fulbright and all these people, yet the protective research files of the Secret Service find no threats. That's tantamount to President Obama visiting Mississippi. Oh, good to go, sir. We have no threats to your life here. And it's very hard to believe. Roy Kellerman even testified to the Warren Commission. He found it unusual. They found no threats in the PRS files.
Yeah. No, definitely. And then so on the local law enforcement stand down, we talked sheriffs. On the police side of things, you mentioned Jesse Curry stopped the police presence at basically the entrance of Dealey Plaza. So just, you know, within Dealey Plaza, there were no police set up.
Very few. There was, to be fair, because, you know, your naysayers, people goes, Vince, you're wrong. There was a few. Yeah, there were a few, but they weren't doing much. They were like being spectators, and there was such distance between officers. Again, they're watching their motorcade. The overpass should have been free of spectators, and yet there was at least one. I think his name was J.C. White. He was on top of – there might have been another one, too. And they weren't doing their job. In fact, Winston Lawson testified to the Warren Commission. He was trying to wave these spectators off the overpass. All the other overpasses in Dallas – and I saw an early one. There's a picture earlier on of them going under underpass. There's one solitary Dallas policeman in like a rain slicker who's standing on top of the overpass there. They get the plaza. He's seen all these what turned out to be railroad workers, maybe somebody else suspicious too. And he's waving them and he's distracted by it when the shooting began. So
Will Fritz said that there was going to be a police car that had machine guns in it in close proximity to the presidential limo, but that was changed the night before. Winston Lawson told the HSCA that he didn't remember who changed it. So what about the machine?
Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry wanted a car there, and separate from Curry's car, Will Fritz wanted a car. Now, see, the thing is, yes, there's a Secret Service fob car, but you can also have a mayor's car. You can also have a sheriff and or police car. When he went to Chicago in March of 63, they had both. When he went to Tampa, they had both. You can have both. And they both were on record in testimony to the Warren Commission, Will Fritz and Jesse Curry. They wanted cars there. And then famously, Seth Cantor in his notes talked about, Will Fritz wanted man there. It was canceled the night before by Secret Service. So, you had the stripping of security that it's less irony or professional law enforcement witnesses there. They're armed. They could have saw something in the building windows and or the grassy knoll and or somewhere else. So you had a lessening of security and a lessening of professional irony or witnesses. That this goes part and parcel with some other things I'm sure we'll get to. But,
Right. Well, let's talk about the next topic, which is reduction of motorcycles. So initially, the Dallas police planned to assign motorcycle escorts alongside the president's limo, which would partially have screened the president from gunfire. These plans were changed on the day before the assassination, and the result was that the motorcycle escort of four police officers were riding behind the limo instead of alongside it. And in the three other cities in Texas on this trip that were before Dallas, San Antonio, Houston, and Fort Worth, there were motorcycles alongside the limo in all of the motorcades in those cities. Agent Lawson wrote in his November 30th report that the motorcycles were alongside the limo, even though he's the one who told the police to not have the motorcycles alongside the limo. Yeah. The rationale for removing the motorcycles was that JFK wanted to be able to speak to Governor and Mrs. Connolly and could not hear, you know, they wouldn't be able to hear and have a conversation with them with the motorcycles nearby. So, Vince, what do you make of the reduction of motorcycles and of Agent Lawson telling the motorcycle police agents to not ride alongside the limo uniquely in Dallas?
They said the House Select Committee, Belford Lawson, no relation to Winston Lawson that we know of, was the Secret Service attorney. And he said, you know, is even a draft memo of his that was released talking about it was a unique occurrence. He made it uniquely secure. The famous talk about how in San Antonio, Houston, Fort Worth, there was many motorcycles. In fact, again, talking about how last 5 to 15 years, a lot of films and photos have been released. We have a lot more San Antonio and Houston in particular, a little bit more Fort Worth. It's kind of short shrift there. But anyway, San Antonio and Houston, and there are a gaggle of motorcycles all around him, flanking him right next to him. And there's just two lines of motorcycles. So again, professional ironeer witnesses, they're armed. So you would have that. They're out of the way. So it gets them out of harm's way. It's less ironeer witness out of the way, less armed people out of the way. So it opened President Kennedy up to a bad security. And again, just like blaming him for everything, the story was that President Kennedy couldn't hear conversation. He didn't like that, but he had no problem the morning before, the day before, the trip before, the many trips before, having many motorcycles. I mean, you should see Tampa, Florida, November 18th is just a textbook of great security. Multi-story building rooftops were guarded. Agents were on the back of the car. They were going at a high rate of speed. He had a military man in a limo. He had many motorcycles beside the car, you know, et cetera. Great protective research section. They found 6 pages of threats, yet he gets to Dallas, so he's warned about it. They found a big, fat goose egg, which could have been one of the covert reasons why security was stripped. We could say, hey, we didn't find anybody. But to get back to the motorcycles in particular, Alan Dulles, of all people, questioned Winston Lawson and said, was there something that President Kennedy said about this? He goes, and this is Winston Lawson, not specifically at this instance, orders from him. Probably, you know, took the air out of the room. And then he quickly followed up with, but it was my understanding that President Kennedy didn't like a lot of motorcycles behind him, beside him. But again, if you look at you got to keep in mind, back in 63, 64, and many years afterwards, people just were taking it on faith that the Secret Service agent must be true then. It's only till, you know, recently a lot of these films and photos have come out and go, my God, look at the phalanx, look at the length of motorcycles beside Kennedy on your side. What is up with this? Why didn't he get this protection? I get this all the time from people who make comments on YouTube and my blogs and other things about photos and films of motorcycles. They always say the same thing. Hey, Vince, how come there's agents around the car, but not in Dallas? How come there's all these, you know, even like 1957 when Queen Elizabeth visited New York City during the Eisenhower days, there's motorcycles all over the car. They have the bubble top on. There's agents walking with police, walking with the limo, running with the limo. So even then you go, look at that. They could do that. But when America's king and queen, JFK and Jackie, gets to Dallas, the city he's warned about, there's a big nothing. It's terrible. You look at the Zapruder film, and Clinton doesn't get to it. Everything's long gone. But you don't see the motorcycles behind the car because they were put behind the rear wheels. And the thing is, like B.J. Martin and some of the other officers testified that they were told, oh, yeah, there was an order not to ride beside the motorcade. Some of them claimed it was that morning. And like famously to Gene Hill, you know, Gene Hill was her boyfriend was B.J. Martin, said, yeah, we were put in a very strange position, whatnot. Now, the thing is, I document all the times they make comments about the motorcade. And even during the Warren Commission, yes, yeah, they were told not to be beside the car. And one of the questioners is kind of like Zapruder, thank you for your film, sir. He said, well, I think that's all, officer. Didn't probe him. Well, who told you this? Why weren't you beside the car? He said, I think that's all, officer. That's their way of like, that was it. And again, you know, no one questioned it, but yeah.
Wow. Okay, so that ties up the motorcycles. I mean, for me, the motorcycles is one of the main things that opened my eyes. I didn't think there was anything to the Secret Service stuff. I mean, I thought they were like, oh, look at all the ways they were grossly negligent. But the motorcycles, and then Lawson lying about it in his report, or misremembering it, or whatever you want to say, I guess here's my question, just one more question on the motorcycles.
Sure.
What's the most compelling counterpoint about why that's not a big deal? Like, are there arguments as to why, like, oh, it's innocent? I mean, I guess the answer is that the motorcycles were loud, but we know that that's nonsense. So
here's the thing. If there wasn't a prior precedent for it, and we didn't have films and photos, and we didn't have Winston Lawson's bizarre statement where he's admitting there's no orders from him specifically in this instance, and following up with what he followed up with, but then we see the films and photos of these trips he's claiming, and you go, well, there was a whole bunch of motorcycles beside the car. It's hard to find an innocent explanation for that. And again, I got to stress something too. I'm not casting aspersions on the Secret Service in general. Most of these men were squeaky clean. Most of these men were just following orders. Even Winston Lawson. Could it be Winston Lawson's lead advance agent, but David Grant, advance agent, fresh from the Tampa, Florida trip, joins him a few days before? Could he be an unsavory influence? And you have Floyd Boring, the planner of the Texas trip, the number two agent, who, again, by his own admission, was in charge of the Texas trip. This real brief, you know, the day Kennedy was shot by Jim Bishop, it's buried in there, but it says if there was any official blame, it didn't matter that the planning of the Texas trip was in the capable hands of Floyd Boring. I remember reading that, and it was just jumping on me like, my God, how come no one's ever mentioned this? And Floyd Boring, most people didn't even know who he was at the time. And I got the JFK Library Oral History, 1999, researcher Bill Adams, who's retired, him and I got the out of the JFK Library. It was buried since 1976, never published. And then in there, Floyd Boring's telling, I was on all the advance work. I did all the advance work for President Kennedy. So obviously it includes Texas, Dallas, whatnot, to the Truman Library, saying the same thing. So the buck stops with the Secret Service when it comes to security or lack thereof. It could be that Winston Lawson was merely conveying. He even admitted to the House Select Committee he was in talks back and forth with Floyd Boring. So Jerry Bain takes his first full vacation during the JFK era. Even Clint Hill and Jerry Blaine of the Kennedy Detail book admitted this to me years before. It was his first vacation on JFK. I was like, well, what a heck of a time to take a vacation. I'm thinking to myself, they admitted in their books this is true. Floyd Boring's plan of Texas trip, he's not there on site. He was there in Tampa when all this great security. They get to Dallas, the Texas trip and whatnot, and all the security is not there. And then the thing is, Matt, which is crazy, I know I'm getting into other areas, maybe we haven't ticked off yet, but you know, the whole thing about the agents on the limo crap is that it's no truth to this. JFK never ordered them off the car. Many of the agents I spoke to said the same thing. Floyd Boring is the guy who's fingered as the one who told the agents not to ride in the car. Clint Hill, during his Warren Commission testimony, told Arnold Spector, I was told by Floyd Boring, I was not on this trip to Tampa, but supposedly President Kennedy told them to get off the back of the car. And so we conveyed that to the agents in Dallas. Why that's not retroactive, but going forward. Okay, so the next trip, you're not going to ride in the back of the car. But meantime, again, only because these films and photos came out in the last 5 to 15 years or so, I'm saying, well, they're back in the car for this trip the whole time. In fact, witnesses I spoke to, Tony Zappone was a photographer who took a couple of famous photos of Kennedy in Tampa. I said, no, the agents were on the back of the car pretty much the whole time. I can't remember. Says maybe when they were going to MacDill Air Force Base when it was all over. The public. So here's the thing. The public's motorcade was over. The public went home. There might have been stragglers. And when they were racing to go back to the airport to take JFK back to Washington, maybe at that point agents were on the back of the car. But it had nothing to do with Kennedy or nothing. It was over. There's no public showing. We're going back. But during the public motorcade, during that 28 miles, they were on the back of the car. And they were often going at a fast clip. So you had that. So it's crazy.
All right, let's go to the luncheon location, which is what dictated the motorcade route. Yeah. So it was between the Women's Building and the Trademark, and Jerry Bruno told the HSCA that he preferred the Women's Building, and so did Kenny O'Donnell, and most importantly, Gerald Bain, the head of the White House Security Detail.
Yep.
But there are also witnesses who say that O'Donnell chose the Trademark because Governor Connally insisted on it, and he did it for, you know, basically political reasons to make
as the cover story.
Yeah, to make Governor Connally's happy, or to make Governor Connally happy. So, Vince, why do you think? Here's my big question for that: who do you think ultimately was the deciding factor there? And then my sub question would be: why would Connally care so much about the luncheon being at the Trademark?
I mean, you're the cover story. They wanted like some of the like the high donors in the Democratic Party. They wanted that the Trademark was a better looking place, whatnot. But the thing is, the Women's Building held a lot more people. It was much better on security grounds. Jerry Bain said when he saw the Trademark, we'll never go there because there was catwalks or worried about snipers, whatnot. And the Women's Building held more people. Four Sorrels of the Dallas office, the local Dallas agent, went out there, checked it out, saw what it's all reported back. Now, here's the thing with the hair in the ointment is Four Sorrels. Now, I have three suspects, but if I was forced to pick a couple other agents that might have towed the went over the line, Four Sorrels is one of them. Came out in FBI reports afterwards that a woman kept calling the Dallas office. And this is during the Garrison time or later on, and maybe had crazy. This is within 24 hours of the assassination. This woman saying that Four Sorrels should be removed from his position, that he was very anti-Kennedy, anti-government. And we know, like, the FBI asked for, you know, requested, do you want our help, you know, during the planning? And Four Sorrels said, no, we don't need you. It's okay. So this is the man is involved in the Trademark decision. Now, here's the thing. The House Select Committee duly noted, and I noted in my first book in the chapter of the Trademark and the Motorcade Route, that they were suspicious about an unnamed assistant to Four Sorrels that could have undermined the position, I'm paraphrasing, of the White House detail. In other words, they were duly aware that Jerry Bain said, we'll never go there, was against the Trademark. Okay, they knew that ostensibly the Women's Building held more people and would have been better for security. And yet, was there an influence on Four Sorrels? And or, in my opinion, it could have just been Four Sorrels. Well, it turns out there's an agent, Robert Stewart. He's an old gentleman. He lived in 1999. He was late 80s at the time. He might have been a little older now. But anyway, he was Four Sorrels' assistant. When I spoke to him, he didn't want to get any details. There's so many things I could tell you. He'd tell me, I can't. There's so many things I could tell you. I'm afraid. I don't want to tell you even now. The phone. I said, you don't want to tell me? Like over the phone? He says, no, there's so many things I could tell you, but I just can't. I'll just tell you one thing, that we were at the Trademark and we were crying when we heard that Kennedy was killed. And I don't want to get into it. And now here's the thing. Author Bill Sloan, JFK author who wrote the book with Gene Hill and Breaking Silence, he interviewed an unnamed Dallas office agent who conveyed the same thing to him, saying, "I'm afraid it's too dangerous to talk about it even now." So privately, when the book came out, I said, "That sounds like, Robert Stewart." I said, "Bill, was that Robert Stewart?" He says, "Vince, I can't lie to you. It was." Says, you can talk about it in your book because your book's not going to be published for us. Yeah, I know. It was Robert Stewart, son of a gun. So the bottom line in this is you had assistant to Forrest Sorrells, who's, it's too dangerous even now in the early 90s at the time, to Bill Sloan and I saying this, who could have been an influence, the House Select Committee saying on the trademark decision, the Secret Service from a security standpoint, that's all they care about is security. They don't care about how nice and fluffy things are and how much they look aesthetically. Women's building was better, yet they go to the trademark, which affected the motorcade route. That made them go through Dealey Plaza. Now, it's another issue about the dog leg turn, because when FDR traveled through Dealey Plaza, he went straight on Main Street. When Senators Kennedy and Johnson in September 1960 went through Dealey Plaza, they also went straight through Main Street, albeit the other direction like FDR did. And Governor Connally said that was the traditional route, parade route. In fact, there's even footage of a St. Patrick's Day parade in like the year 1960 or late 50s, it shows them going straight through Main Street, no dog leg turn. So that opens up another can of worms, how the decision to go to the trademark affected the motorcade route, which also is a sidebar, did this bizarre dog leg turn. They could have gone straight on Main. And Jerry Bruno, the Democratic National Committee fans man, who talked to William Manchester in the House Select Committee, said, "Boy, if they just only would have went to the Women's Building, they would have been going at a much faster rate of speed, would have been going straight on Main Street, they would have been away from the Book Depository and the Grassy Knoll, obviously." So that opened up all that. So what I think, to make a long story very short for to answer you, your initial question, is I think that there was undue sinister influence either by Sorrells and or his assistant, maybe someone else, and they were aware of it. And that affected them going to where they go. Because Jerry Bain is the head of the White House detail. Doesn't get any higher than that. Right. So he's saying, "We'll never go there." And then all of a sudden they're going there. And they're not going to acquiesce to Governor Connally. I'm sorry. He might have been the host. But when it comes to the president and his party, they're the ones. It would be tantamount to Trump going somewhere. But sir, the governor doesn't want you to do that. You know what Trump would say? Go pound salt. We're going where we're going. Even President Biden and Obama would say, "We're going where the president wants to go, not where the governor wants to go." So that's
That's true. All of them, I agree with that. All the presidents like being president.
Yeah, that's it, man.
All right. So bottom line, yeah, you don't think it's Kenny O'Donnell. You think it's
Although I got a little footnote. Sorry, Matt, everything has a little footnote. Tiny little footnote. Joseph McBride, great author, great guy. He's suspicious of Kenny O'Donnell. So if there's anybody that is in a camp that doesn't think Kenny O'Donnell's squeaky clean, you know, Kenny O'Donnell was famously blamed for taking the bubble top off. And yet his daughter, Helen, who's also an author, said, "There's no truth to that. My dad was only involved in the motorcade ride. He was involved in that. And he also didn't order the aides off the car." Yet there's this big myth. And part of it, to be fair, is from Kenny O'Donnell's book, "Johnny, We Hardly Knew You," written with Dave Powers. After speaking to Sam Kinney, he was there and was adamant that he took the bubble top off. It had nothing to do with Kenny O'Donnell or anybody else. I think it was, frankly, to sell books. 10 years later, 10th anniversary assassination, to sell some books. Here was Kenny O'Donnell coming out saying he had something to do with the bubble top. You know, maybe it was a little bit of his guilt. Who knows? Maybe it was to sell books. But see, the sad thing is that it created this myth. It just furthered the myth that President Kennedy, he didn't want that bubble top on. He didn't want those agents behind him. Meantime, like another agent told me, presidents have so much in their mind. They're leaders of the free world. They're the commander-in-chief. They're worried about their speech site. They're worried about this, that, and the other. They're not worried about, is Joe Jones behind me? Are we going to have this roof on or not? Are there motorcycles behind? They're thinking about other things than that.
Right.
So,
all right, let's go on to the motorcade route then. So we talked, all right, so they decided they're going to the trademark. Now they got to figure out how they're going to get from Love Field to the trademark. So Sergeant Sam Bella said that Captain Perdue Lawrence came to his house late on the night before the assassination to tell him that the new motorcade route had the 120-degree turn from Houston to Main to Elm, or, well, the 120-degree dogleg turn from Houston to Main Street to Elm. Bella said that they were originally planning to go straight down Main Street, like you were talking about, through the center of Dealey Plaza, instead of turning on Elm, closer to the depository building and the grassy knoll, and necessitating a dramatic slowdown. So my question for you, Ben, says the concrete divider in the road that is there, because that's the reason that they say, hey, we couldn't go straight down Main and then turn right after we get past the railroad overpass.
Correct.
Or underpass, whatever. They say it's a concrete divider. And when I heard that, I said, well, wow, yeah, they definitely can't. And then I went to the old Google Maps street view and looked at the concrete divider, and it's maybe 6 inches, 10 inches off the ground. Maybe a foot is really, really pushing it.
Oh, it's not a foot. I've been there several times. It's not a foot. Yeah.
The one that's there today, is that the same concrete divider that was there in 63? Do we know?
Not the same, guys. It's through the years that, you know, it's been a little bit of, you know, maybe new asphalt, new things, a little bit, but basically more or less it's the same. But even before, let's even give the doubters their due. Say, oh, you know, there was that concrete divider and they couldn't put a little awkward ramp and do whatever they're going to do, which is bull. They've done things like that in the past. But let's just say, okay, that's true. Main to industrial, they could have went. They could have went Main to industrial. And again, when FDR went straight through Main Street, they were going straight through Main Street. Didn't have to go that dog leg turn to get to the freeway and all that other stuff. When JFK and LBJ were senators, September 1960, they went straight through Main Street, Dealey Plaza. There's one single solitary source that debunks the whole thing about Main to industrial. It's Assistant Captain Lumpkin.
Right.
Says that there was wine, it was broken pavement. That's why we didn't go. And that was a high select committee. I guess they were satisfied. They reported one guy. Here's the thing is that wherever the president goes, the people go. President Kennedy visited the slums of Harlem, New York, slums of Harlem, New York, the slums of Caracas, Venezuela. Okay, it's an industrial. We have an industrial boulevard in my community. Yeah, it's not ritzy, but it's okay. It's adequate. Wherever the people go, they're going to go. Security reasons, it makes so much more sense to go Main to industrial. You don't have to do this dog leg turn. So they could have done that. There's prior precedence of them doing it. But what it is people get on this thing about the concrete divide. He had to build an awkward wooden ramp to go over it. You don't even need to do that. You could just go straight down Main Street. You wouldn't have to do all that. In fact, Sam Kinney, when I interviewed him, admitted to his alternate routes. And he even said that one of our alternate routes was through the seedier side of town, basically admitting it was the Main to industrial. But again, wherever the president's going to go, the people are going to go. Paul Landis, in his two lengthy reports, one of them talked about there was these typical used car dealerships and junk dealers, whatnot, we passed in the suburban areas. Okay, those aren't ritzy. Those aren't great. Not every area of Dallas was ritzy and whatnot, but President Kennedy went to 10 miles. I'm sure when he went to Tampa, Florida, all 28 miles weren't squeaky clean and wonderful. So just to go through Industrial Boulevard, there's going to be police there. There's going to be security there. Everything's going to be fine. These winos and broken pavement are going to rear their ugly head to hurt anything. It was just the excuse that was given, ironically, by one source, too. And Lumpkin was part of military intelligence, too. Anybody who has any suspicions about him and whatnot. But the thing about the motorcade route really seals the deal for me beyond being a traditional parade route and whatnot. Jerry Bain, the head of the White House detail, you know, everybody talks about, you know, David Lifton always says his big thing on the case was the Seibert and O'Neill report was his big opening. Like, my God, September 27th, 1992 is mine. When I spoke to Jerry Bain, he told me two things. We'll get to the other one in a moment. The first thing he talked about was, well, yeah, the hostile could be. Yeah, they interviewed me. And I kind of knew about the staff interviews, which were eventually released a few years later. But he goes, I was interviewed in an executive session, too. And he, by the way, Matt, those still have not been released. His executive session testimonies have never been found, never been released. Same with Maurice Martineau, the head of the Chicago office, and I think other people's as well. They released the staff interviews, not behind closed doors executive session. But anyway, I got the scoop. I said, well, what did they ask you, sir? I said, well, they asked me about the Florida trip and why the motorcade route was changed for Dallas. I was like, was it changed for Dallas? He goes, I know it was changed, but why? I've forgotten completely. I don't know. Now, we can focus on people saying, oh, he's full of events. He knew why it was changed. He was lying to you. He knew the reason. Forget that. He's confirming the motorcade route was changed for Dallas. That's right. All you have to focus on. It's all this stuff about, oh, you know, the people on the other side say, oh, this motorcade was etched in stone. They could only go Houston to Elm. They're full of it. There's nothing to this. It's patently false. And we have the special in charge of the White House detail who was involved in the planning, albeit he was on vacation and fully born pretty much took over as November drew, on towards the Dallas trip, he was there, and he's saying that the House of Lincoln asked him why the motorcade route was changed in Dallas behind closed doors. And again, the ARB never released them, never found them. I talked to Jefferson Morley about this, and he was fascinated. I said, yeah, the executive sessions were never found, never released. But again, just go by that. It's not some conspiracy author.
In theory, Congress has the ability to declassify that because that's a congressional record. So
yeah,
have to get the congressional committee hip to that. All right. Yeah. Here next, we have a rebuttal on this topic.
Sure.
And, I'm just going to toss the rebuttal to you. I'm not even going to try to answer it. I'm going to let you.
There you go.
Okay. All right. So rebuttal from John in Fairfield, Connecticut. Matt, how can Bella, Sergeant Bella, think the plan is to drive over the divider until late on the evening of November 21st, when the route, which had the turn onto Elm Street, was published on November 19th? Did the police not read the newspaper? So what he's saying is...
I got a rebuttal for both.
Right, but Bella's saying, hey, the night before, they told me that we're changing the route and it's going to go onto Elm. But really that had been published on the 19th and the cops should have seen it. So that's the argument. What do you say to that?
What I say to that is what I reported in my first book, how there was newspaper obfuscation and just some bizarre things. Sometimes the motorcade route was told that it was going to go straight down Main Street. Sometimes they mentioned the dog leg turn. Sometimes they had the map of them going straight down Main Street. And one time they had the motorcade route going Elm. So obviously something's not correct here. Something's wrong. There's two streams of information. In fact, even people believe Oswald acted alone. Okay, what newspaper did he read? What map did he see? What text did he read? Because again, I document this in the first book. For every newspaper that said they were going the dog leg turn, Houston Elm, they also talked about Main Street. So nothing was black and white there. And again, Sergeant Bella, Dallas police officer, he was a sergeant. He was part of the lead motorcycle officers. He was involved in the planning. If he's saying there was a motorcade route change, I have a tendency to believe him. Special agent in charge of the White House detail tells me that he was asked about the motorcade route being changed. Then you also, but the agents tell me there were alternate routes. He had that as well. See, and then also you have about this concrete divider. Forget the concrete divider. They could have went straight down Main Street and avoided a concrete divider. That's a red herring. I even can see that's a little awkward. Yes, they could have, but would they really have built a ramp to go over this thing? No, I mean, he could have. Leaves an option, but they could have went straight down Main Street. Again, JFK and LBJ. Ironically, the last time President Kennedy and LBJ were never in a motorcade together, all during the presidency until November 22nd, the last time was September 1960 in Dallas and Fort Worth. They visited both cities, and then he's going straight down Main Street, as FDR did. In fact, during Forrest Sorrell's Warren Commission testimony, he talks about going straight down Main Street with FDR, albeit the other direction, but still it is what it is. But so this thing about it wasn't etched in stone. It depends on what avenue. If you believe Oswald acted alone out there, what happens if you read the newspaper, it was only going straight down Main Street? You'd say, well, damn, I'm not going to be able to hit him from here. So it depends. What did he read? And again, it's convoluted because it seems like the official story was they were going to go straight down Main Street. Then it was this change. Now, the change could have been between the 18th to the 19th. I spoke to Jerry Kivett, who was a top LBJ top LBJ Secret Service agent, along with Rufus Youngblood, was one of his deputies. He was there in the motorcade. And he talked about how he got there early for the Butler's convention. Vice President Johns says, I think the motorcade route was changed somewhere around the 19th. So he even didn't concede there was a motorcade route change, but he made the 19th instead of the 18th. So this is pretty interesting in and of itself. And then you got a convoluted, nothing is black and white, as some people on the other side want. They want to say their basic thrust is they only could have went Houston to Elm. There's no way. That's totally false, without even doing the concrete divider issue. And again, when you got the Congress, House looking at me asking Jerry Bain, and Jerry Bain confirming there was a change, and you have these other talk about Bobby Joe Dale, a Dallas police officer, to Larry Sneed in his book No More Silence, even says there was three ways we were going to exit Love Field that morning, and we decided the last moment to take the one through the fence that they took down. So even there, nothing's black and white. They're talking about, well, when did they went this way and this way? No, they went this way. So,
right. All right, let's go to the next topic. Motorcade lineup changes at Love Field. Hey, that's a good transition. So There were six anomalies in the motorcade lineup that I counted. The first one you just mentioned, that was the only motorcade with the JFK and LBJ together while he was president, which is a little weird because, you know, the whole point of a vice president is to take over if the president's killed. You don't want him in close
proximity. Both in the car together. Yeah.
Right. So, but I just want to hit on the other five things really quick. JFK's personal physician, Admiral Berkeley, was normally either in the presidential limo or the Secret Service follow-up car. But in Dallas,
or the lead car.
But in Dallas and Rome only, he was somewhere else. And in Dallas, he was in the bus at the rear of the motorcade.
And he protested, and Evelyn Lincoln is a witness. Evelyn Lincoln being JFK's personal secretary, and she's a witness to Dr. Berkeley protesting, saying, "I got to be closer. This isn't so unfair, untrue." Bishop reported. I think Manchester did too, but Bishop did too. And in the House Select Committee revealed this years later, talking about, and again, Dr. Berkeley said, the only other time I could think of that I wasn't close to the president was in Rome. Here's the thing about Rome. Rome was beautiful security. Otherwise, agents were on the back of the car. They're going on a fast clip. There's a lot of motorcycles. Multi-story building rooftops were guarded. The press was right in front of the limo. I'm sure we'll get to that in a second, taking photos and films of the motorcade. So, yeah, so that's why I said not every trip was like stellar security, A plus. Sometimes you had one deficiency here and there due to manpower or whatnot, maybe cutting corners, but not a whole shebang was out the window. And so just like not agents weren't always in the back of a car, Matt, but what they would do to counter that would be multi-story building rooftops being guarded or plainclothes detectives being in the crowds, facing the crowds, being in the crowds to circumvent that. So you had that. So,
all right. And then so JFK aide and loyalist General Godfrey McHugh normally rode between the driver of the limo and the Secret Service agent in the front seat. So he would have been between Greer and Kellerman in Dallas. Right. Yeah. He was moved to the back of the motorcade in Dallas for the first time ever. The only place, which left that space wide open. So quick question to you, Vince, on this. Do we know who told General McHugh and Admiral Berkeley to move? Like, do we know who was the impetus for them actually being in a different spot?
We know in general who it was the Secret Service. No agent was specifically mentioned. Godfrey McHugh, in 1976, the Canadian radio, CFTR radio, so again, 1976, said that, yeah, the Secret Service told me not to ride there as I normally did. It was unusual. I usually took notes and made observations. And they said they did that to accentuate full exposure. So that really is grist for the mill. And he told basically the same thing to the House Select Committee 2 years later, 1978. Now, it's either Godfrey McHugh or military aide Ted Clifton, who usually, not always, but usually, this is true, rode between the agent in charge, who usually was Jerry Bain, sometimes Floyd Boring. In this case, it was a third stringer, Roy Kellerman, and Bill Greer, who wasn't always the driver. We'll get to that in a second. But, you know, Greer and Kellerman would have been a military aide normally there. Again, sinister minds would say, was that because a professional eye and ear witness is out of the way? He's also out of harm's way during the shooting. Ironically, he would have been shot and maybe killed during the assassination. He's out of the way as well. He was just there in Tampa, and many other trips, either Clifton or McHugh were there. So not only do we have, you know, not jumping ahead about military, you know, being present in the multi-story building rooftops not being guarded. Yet a military aide was told by the Secret Service. He just didn't name a specific agent, and no one asked him follow up. Oh, who was the agent? You know, one thought to ask him that, but it's gone forever because Godfrey McHugh's dead. But
so it was the Secret Service, bottom line, but we don't know who exactly. Okay. All right, so a couple other motorcade lineup changes. The order of the motorcade cars were changed around, which is interesting. The cars all had numbers written on them, and it was just all a big shuffle. Everything was moved around, so that was pretty interesting. Yes. And here's the couple of big ones that are related. Official White House photographer Cecil Stoughton was kicked out of the follow-up car and made to move to the back of the motorcade when he normally rode a follow-up car.
Yes.
And the first time ever after July 1963 that Stoughton was not in the Secret Service follow-up car was in Dallas. So, again, one more thing that is unique to Dallas, a novelty only in Dallas, happened for the first time. So that's,
yeah, he was there in San Antonio taking photos. There's beautiful photos of him in San Antonio in the follow-up car. You can see the head of Emory Roberts, the head of Sam Kinney. There's JFK Jackie. Oh, it's a beautiful one I have in my collection of Tampa. And there's Cecil Stoughton taking photos. It'd be either Robert Knudsen, the other White House photographer, or Cecil Stoughton taking photos. They often, in fact, Cecil Stoughton in a letter to me said, I often rode, in fact, I even sometimes rode on the back of the car holding onto the handrail taking photos as well as the fall car. Matt, he didn't answer my question. He avoided my question. I did ask, who told you not to be there? Why weren't you there? You know what he said? He basically said, I'm disturbed by your interest in these matters. Is this for a book, perhaps? So he answered my questions honestly. He said that I don't remember the president ever saying anything about not having agents in the back of the car. And he went on and on about, yeah, normally I did ride the FOB car. And then he just stopped and says, I'm disturbed by your interest in these matters. There's a book in the offing or whatnot. And then he ended up dying in 2008. But I got him in a couple letters. So, you know, saying what he confirmed. And again, the photographic evidence shows him there, him or Knudsen riding there. And again, it just makes you think, my God, if he would have been there in Dallas snapping away, you know, there's Dave Powers and Kenny O'Donnell who might have been there instead of or in addition to Cecil Stone, would history be different? We'd have beautiful shots of the knoll, the overpass. We wouldn't have to rely on Abraham Zapruder. And then, Matt, I don't know if this is going to be a follow-up about the flatbed truck that normally rode in front of the limo.
That's where I'm going next.
Yeah. Well, normally a flatbed truck, sometimes more than one, rode in front of the presidential limousine filled with White House press corps, all members of the press, AP, UPI, professional eye and ear witnesses taking films and photos. Sometimes even a live television feed, which was the case in Rome, Italy, and also in San Diego, California, cracks me up. There's a video out there. Some people try to say Secret Service stand on debunked. I know who it is. It's David Von Peen. And he uses a fake name. He says, that, yeah, this whole bull crap about it being a stand on. Look at this motorcade. There's not agents on the back of the car. Meantime, the video shows a gaggle of Marines line the street facing the crowd, not the limousine, facing the crowd. The guy is even saying, look at the Marines stationed 5 feet apart. There's a whole bunch of motorcycles. And more importantly, there's also Jerry Bain in the limousine. There's two flatbed trucks. And the reason why we have a live television feed right in front of the limo, it's coming from the flatbed truck. And multi-story building rooftops were guarded. So people like David Von Peen and Lone Nutters, they do this gotcha game, Matt. They say, I got a motorcade of Kennedy's from 1962. I don't see agents on the back of the car. I'm not saying agents were always there. It didn't want a police state. Sometimes there was manpower limitations and whatnot, but what they did to get around that, again, was multi-story building. Rooftops being guarded, detectives being in the crowds themselves, police facing the crowd, military facing the crowd. When you have that in conjunction, again, this isn't good for today's post-9/11 terrorist world, but in the days of Thompson submachine guns, pistols, worried about lone nuts or maybe like a gaggle of kooks and whatnot, that was tremendous security. That's the reason why FDR, Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy lived up November 22nd. It wasn't rubbing a rabbit's foot. I have newspaper articles of FDR, Truman, and Eisenhower. In fact, Matt, this is amazing. This came out in 2020. It's on my YouTube channel several times over. During a COVID lockdown, this gentleman had an amazing YouTube channel. His YouTube channel went under not long afterwards. Probably was copyright violations. He had so much of the network footage of the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, all these different presidential things. He had a clip I've never seen before. And thank God I was able to use the terminology, rip it and make a copy of it. Ron Gardner of ABC telling the world, Kennedy was still alive, by the way. He was not pronounced dead. He's telling the world, I can't understand how this could happen. Normally, multi-story building rooftops are guarded. This has been going on for years. Normally, there's agents or police guarding the rooftops. And it turns out in two books that were written before the assassination, written with the help of Chief Inspector Michael Torino, who I spoke to. Chief Michael Torino wrote the Secret Service manual. If anybody in the world knows security, he would. He wrote these books. One's called the United States Secret Service. The other one's called What Would a Secret Service Agent Do? Right there in it says, whenever a president's in a parade, building rooftops are guarded by agents and police. Again, this is written before the assassination. So you have those two books. You have Ron Gardner saying what he said. There's a couple existing photographs that do show police on rooftops. Keep in mind, normally the focus is on Kennedy, so it was peripheral, it was in addition to whatnot.
Right.
Then you also have the documents that weren't shredded by the Secret Service. The Tampa trip came out. The documents came out in the late 1990s. Says the sheriff's department will guard all buildings along the route. So now the follow-up to any naysayers, hey Vince, that's good for multi-story buildings. When is Kennedy was shot from a ranch dressing? What do you ranch building? You got to fluff every once in a while. Ranch building. Well, what would you do in a situation like that? What they did is they had the police or military line street facing the crowd. So a ranch building is on that level, so they're right. Able to see. In fact, there's even photos of the military. Police line, they have their little MP badges on, and they're lining the streets in Tampa on that line. But anything higher, it was guarded by the sheriff's department. In fact, Russell Groover, who's the head motorcycle officer, told me, I spoke to him several years back, and he said that, oh yeah, every multi-story building was armed to the teeth of men, that anything untoward, they would have blew them away. That's why we felt pretty good about President Kennedy's protection in Tampa. Then you had the two agents riding on the back of the car holding the handrails. One of them was Don Lawton. We'll get to that in a second, but
Yeah, and let me ask you just back to the flatbed truck and the cancellation of that. So there seems to be a dispute between Winston Lawson and Jack Puterbaugh about who actually made the order for reducing removing the flatbed truck. Do you think, just could you quickly speak on Jack Puterbaugh and the extent to which you think he had any actual authority to do anything? Just the only reason I say that is because there are, as we get into LBJ, Puterbaugh, spoiler alert, but Puterbaugh is the guy LBJ sends into the Department of Agriculture to clean up the Billy Sol Estes mess.
Yeah.
And when I saw that and I saw him here, I went, hey now. So what, could you just speak to Puterbaugh's role from just in terms of everything, you know?
Yeah. Well, Jack Puterbaugh, he was a Democrat National Committee advance man like Marty Underwood and Jerry Bruno. Jerry Bruno, his Confederate, wrote a book called The Advance Man in the early 70s, basically saying if only they would have went down Main Street, he wanted the women's building. Marty Underwood said he talked to JFK the day before and said, we're getting all these reports, you're going to be assassinated the day before. And JFK said to Marty, oh, Marty, you worry about me too much. Well, Jack Puterbaugh, one of their compadres, was very forthcoming with authors and researchers through the years. You know, Larry Hapana in 1970, Newcomb and Adams, David Lifton also drew from the interview. Puterbaugh answered all their questions, said he had nothing to do with the motorcade ride. That's a Secret Service, right? And he's right. The Secret Service is the final authority when it comes to motorcade positioning, order, security. Just like this hogwash about Bill Moyers is supposedly the one to order the bubble top off. Get that goddamn bubble top off unless it's raining. There's no truth to that. There's no way in the world the White House detail under President Kennedy is going to listen to an LBJ aide. That would be, again, making it modern terms. Hey, an aide to Vice President Vance wants Trump's men to do something. They laugh in his face and get lost. But it takes on. People love it because it's sexy and romantic when it comes to the LBJ did it theory. Hey, we want Bill Moyers involved. Yeah. Bill Moyers ordered off the bubble top. He didn't have the authority. To answer your question directly, Jack Puterbaugh wouldn't have had the authority. Not only was he very open in an interview. In fact, right before he died, like there was interviews of him during the 50th anniversary, somewhere around there. And he was very forthcoming. He was an old man at the time. And he was interviewed galore. And beyond being very open and accessible to people, because you could say, oh, maybe he's lying. He's just doing that. Bottom line, the pecking order. Here's a Democratic National Committee advance man. Here's the Secret Service. Now, what they did do was patronage, type of things. You know, he'd be very good. Jack Puterbaugh and Marty Underwood and Jerry Bruno would be very good at patronage and issues like that. Hey, we want to get this advertising gentleman and these congressmen and senators. We want them proper seating. We want them better seated next to the vice president and the president. Things like that, they were wonderful. The Secret Service had nothing to do with that. That's more just patronage and, trying to window dressing and whatnot. But when it comes to security issues, he had nothing to do with that. So my answer is no. In fact, it's Winston Lawson and Roger Warner, who were the two agents specifically involved in the motorcade order or lack thereof when it comes to things that were deleted and ordinary. The two, you had the Will Fritz and Dallas squad cars filled with people armed were taken out. You had the flatbed trucks taken out. He had the motorcade order change. I know Milton Wright, who drove Mayor Cabell's car, said the last minute their motorcade, their order was changed and they were put where they were put. Roger Warner, interestingly enough, went on to a career in the CIA after the Secret Service days. That was his first presidential motorcade. And anybody who's like, whoa, a man who went on the CIA, James Mastrovito, was in charge of the JFK files. Well, then a man who went on a career in the CIA after he left the Secret Service, certainly after, was involved in the motorcade planning in Dallas. So definitely makes you think, wow, at the very least. Oh, you also, one more connection is the night the limousine was inspected by Floyd Boring, Deputy Chief Paul Paterni was in the OSS and worked hand in glove with James Jesus Angleton and Roy Rocha, who was the liaison to the Warren Commission. So he had that guy with his hands on bullet fragments, skull particles, beat the FBI to the punch. They were there. Sinister minds would say, they may do with planning things, taking things away. Certainly leads to suspicion. But anyway, the flatbed truck and the order, the buck stops at the Secret Service. LBJ aides and other people couldn't have done that, even if they wanted to. Like, oh, the other thing is, what's her name? Betty Forsling Harris about the bubble top. She had nothing to do. She couldn't have, even if she wanted to remove the bubble top. They were looking at this lady and said, get away. Sure. You have no authority to do it. But see, it's sexy. Years later, when people heard they have a connection to LBJ, they love it. So they're like, oh, I want this to work. This fits in my theory. They didn't have the authority. Even if she wanted something to happen, it couldn't have done so.
That's it for part one. Part two will be out on Friday.
Save big money on your entire roofing project at Menards. Owens Corning Architectural Shingles are the number one brand trusted by contractors. With a limited lifetime and up to 130 miles per hour wind warranty, protecting your home for years to come. Choose from over 40 options and save big money on all Owens Corning shingles now at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money.